Hilda is a powerful young lady, and there's a lot of accolades we could give her. But if there is one thing that always moves me deeply, is meeting someone for the first time without knowing them, and them having such an impact on you that when you go and read their accolades, you're not surprised. This is a lioness, and she's not just a lioness from an African perspective. She's a lioness from a global perspective. Being arrested, close encounters with police in the USA, in Germany, in France, in Uganda. Being a co-founder of Fridays for the Future, hailing the message of a just energy transition and a beautiful global future. At platforms like COP26, United Nations, okay? And now here's another interesting thing. I wanted to interview her about a year ago, and she was pregnant, and she was still at it. And one of the things we discuss in this show or in this podcast is what it's like to go from being somebody who's fearless on the front lines, willing to get arrested, not afraid to get arrested, to being a mother, right? Who's still in the same space. Do you still take the same risks? What happens to your fire? So look, guys, I can go on and on, but Hilda is, I don't know, when I say her name, I just feel it. I feel it, man. I feel it in my heart. I feel it in my belly. She's a force to be reckoned with. And I have no doubt that you're going to love this episode. Enjoy.
Welcome aboard our jet. The Just Energy Transition is a new podcast with the goal of amplifying the stories that matter most. Our mission? A Just Energy Transition, raising the voices of untold inspiring stories. At JET, we hope every listener becomes a true activist and every story a catalyst for real change.
Hilda, how are you doing?
Hi, Adani. I'm good. How are you doing?
I am absolutely fine. I believe you just had a little one.
Yes.
He or she?
He.
He. What's his name?
Yeah. He's called Noble. To mean royal?
Oh, right. Well, okay. Good. Okay. Meaning royal. What inspires you to give the little man such a name?
Well, it wasn't my idea. It was the father's idea.
How old is he now?
He's a year now.
And what is it like to be someone that's dedicated to the just energy transition? Somebody who's dedicated to the movement. I know you're very, very active. What is it like now to be a mother to a newborn? What is it like now to be a new mother in terms of your work? Are you still as hardcore as you used to be, or have you just taken a maternity leave?
Well, it's quite different being a mother and being on the front lines of the climate crisis, being a human rights defender or a fighter of justice. At some point, you have to make decisions that normal human beings would never make. And at some point, you have to make sacrifices. So you have to weigh the options you have, which wasn't the case before when I hadn't given birth, when I was in the movement, but I didn't have a child. So it was quite different. Then I would, make every weird, crazy decisions or movements. But right now, it's a bit different that you have to think for your life and for the life of the little ones. So you have to rethink what to do. Of course, it comes with a lot of needs or requirements from baby. You have to create time for them. You have to create time for work as well. So you only have 24 hours a day of which you need to rest. So you have to, I do have to know what time this should happen or what time this should happen. But that reduced my hours of work as a mother. Yeah.
So tell me, do you have somebody helping you, a family member or a nanny, or are you and the father, it's just the two of you helping each other?
No, I have someone helping me.
Okay. You spoke about something that I think is easy to parse over, but it's not, and it's the reason why you caught my attention when I met you at the Don't Gas Africa conference. You said you have to make decisions, you know, be vigilant about your life, and you have to make decisions that are not crazy, etc. So what kind of decisions are these that you are referring to?
So being a climate activist, and I am currently in Uganda. Uganda, as you may know, has a repressed civic space, and that calls for more security attention. So sometimes the activities we do as climate activists impact our lives. For instance, since we have a repressed civic space in our country, for example, organizing a climate strike is considered risky by the government or the officials. So having a march, for instance, that has hundreds or even just tens of people is also very risky. So you find that all the activities that you can do, the more mobilizing or organizing events for awareness, are considered risky in the country. So you have to devise means of how you can echo the same climate information that you want to give to the people, but as well following the instructions or the rules set by the authorities or the government. However, it's very different when it comes to the law, because we have a right to protest. We have a right to assemble. We have a right to speak. And so that conflicts with what is being done in practice. So in Uganda, when you organize a climate strike or a climate march, and you invite thousands or hundreds of people, you will be disrupted. So you expect any of those, and you find that the decisions you can make while you are a climate activist in Uganda are quite different from the ones or the climate activists make in, for example, Europe or the USA, because the roles and the practice are a bit different. Many of the roles in the US or in Europe that are set in the papers are what happens in practice, but it's not the case here, I think, for many countries in Africa. So I draw that because I've experienced both sides as a climate activist. And when it was so hard to organize or mobilize in Uganda, we tried doing it outside Africa, so in Europe and in the US, and it was way different. I remember the first time I got arrested, I was still at the university, and that was in Kampala. And we had organized a climate strike of about 100 people. So I was in my second year. And
at this university, the University of Kampala?
Yes, Kampala International University. And I was in my second year, and it was my first time to organize a climate track of more than five people, because we were about 100 people. So we stormed the street in Kampala, and we were holding placards, and we were really ready to act. We had informed the police about this action because the law requires us to inform the police. And then in the middle of the action, we got stopped by policemen who even had guns. And they were asking us, why are you doing this? Do you have any permissions? So we told them, yes, we got permission from the police here and here. And we are students. We are not political activists. We are climate activists. And these are our demands. This is what our placard says. This is what it means, because it had climate information everywhere. So we try to explain ourselves that what we are doing is called a climate march, and it's because of climate awareness reasons or climate education to the public or to the masses. And they said that we shouldn't be doing that because it's against the law. Mm-hmm. And they told us that that is the last time that they are warning us. However, we requested, because they wanted to arrest us. And what I did with my colleague, who, because we were the main organizers, we talked to them and we told them to let the other people go, and they can maybe arrest us because we organized the whole event. Wow. So they detained us and questioned us for hours.
So you actually requested them to arrest you as the leaders of the movement.
Yes. Because we are the ones who had invited other people for the march.
So how many were you?
We were about 100 people.
And was this on campus or off campus?
Off campus.
Where was it?
In Kampala, on the streets of Kampala, like in the center, in the middle of the town. Yeah.
Oh, so in the central business district. So they detained you. How many of you were detained?
The two of us who were the organizers, me and the colleague, and they questioned us for hours about why we were doing that. And we kept on saying the same things over and over again, because there was nothing to hide, really. Mm. And one of the questions that really stood out that they asked several times is, who is funding you? Who is funding who sent you to do this? So it seemed as if we cannot organize this on our own. There has to be some, you know, big force or, you know, big money behind what we were doing. So we explained, we even showed our university IDs to show that we are students of this university. We are studying this and this particular course. And, you know, we shared all the details in full. And after, I think, there were about 5 hours of, you know, questioning and stuff, they let us go. That was the first time. Then the second time, we organized a global climate strike. So it was on the same day with other strikes in other countries around the world. So we also organized one here in Kampala.
What was the name of that movement?
The Fridays for Future movement.
Okay, and it was all about just climate in general, or a specific aspect of climate?
So it was climate in general. And for our case in Uganda, because by that time, what we wanted to do is to create awareness about the climate crisis, because not so many people in Uganda are aware of the climate crisis. So it was very more like independent in the countries where it took place, because we have different priorities when it comes to the climate crisis. So in some countries, it will be, for example, like fossil fuels. In other So this second time, we were in a place called Gaba. It's along Lake Victoria. It has many, many people. It was a market day, so we expected thousands of people to be present to listen to us, you know, to give us audience. And so we went to the street, to the marketplace in Gaba landing site, which is along Lake Victoria in Uganda. And we started to talk to people about the climate crisis, you know, about climate change, you know, in general, what it means for Ugandans, what it is, and, you know, all that. So during this awareness session, we still got approached by police. And they were very, very furious with us because that was the time when political campaigns were taking place in the country. So this was 2020. And they were very, very furious. They were asking us questions, you know, why are you doing this? So most of our placards were like in different colors, like yellow, red, green, and blue. You know, we had all these charts and things like that, materials like that. So they thought that we are political campaigners because our charts were colored, and they kept asking us which political party do you belong to, because we see you with multiple colors. So we told them we are not affiliated to any political party. We are environmental activists, and this That's is right. what we want to communicate, climate change. And that was the first time I think they arrested me, like serious arresting, because the first one was more like a detention, but this one was a serious arrest. I had to call my parents to bail me out. And yeah, it wasn't easy. My dad was so furious. And the first question he asked me was, "What did I send you to school to strike or to study?" So I had to spend that day at the police station because he wasn't willing to bail me out. So
you had to learn your lesson. So you stayed. So your dad said, I said, "Well done, policeman. Good. Keep her here." Because she's messing with her future. What were you studying, by the way?
So I was studying a bachelor's degree in procurement and supply chain management. Which
so
was
you were studying commerce?
Yeah, I was studying business.
You're studying business and your father's expecting you to graduate and get an MBA and become an executive. But you're busy on the streets here with placards. interfering with the political dynamics of the country. Okay, so your dad said this. How did you feel when he gave you that kind of a reaction?
Well, I knew that I was in trouble because to make matters worse, I had gone home and picked my younger brothers and sisters and brought them into the match. So they were underage. One was 8, another was 12, and they arrested them as well. So this time they arrested all of us.
Yeah.
So I was more in trouble. So I didn't think about my feelings. I thought about what I had done, because I didn't think about this before, that it would happen or, you know, be to this extent. And I had to first cater for the young ones before myself, because I hadn't even gotten my parents' permission to bring them to the match. So I called another friend of mine who bailed the kids out. So they went home safely, but after being detained for about 8 hours, so they went home later on, and we had to stay at the police station to argue things out. And still, one of the biggest questions that they were asking was, who is funding you? Who has sent you? You know, you are university students. Why are you doing this? These are like big topics or big agendas for big people. Why would students, you know, do this kind of work do these kind of things. So that is what happened. But after some days, they let us out. And then the other time was I got arrested in Europe, and that was in Paris. So we had a campaign called Stop ECOP. ECOP stands for the East African Crude Oil Pipeline. So we had mobilized many people in to stand in solidarity with us in many countries across the world. And one of the biggest countries that had organized the strike was France. And this is because one of the biggest funders or the leading organizations or companies for this East African crude oil pipeline is Total Energies. And Total Energies is a French company. So most of our mobilization went to France to make the people in France aware of what Total as a company was doing in our country, Uganda. So we had mobilized like many people, thousands of people, and we had an action.
In which part of France was this? Was it,
it was
Paris?
Yes, it was in Paris, and we had an action where we invited many people to participate. And most especially youth, they really, really showed up. And during the action, which was with one of the funders of Total Energies, like one of the biggest investors in Total Energies, I won't mention the name, but we were at this organization's offices, and we were really like striking and arguing, you know, asking for the numbers, you know, telling them about the destructions that Total's money is doing in our countries and the people affected, and how bad the East African crude oil pipeline will, you know, will affect our lands, our water, our health as people, but also our climate, because we share the air, so whatever affects us affects our neighbors, and you know, so on and so forth. And so we gave this research and the numbers to the people, but they were not listening. So during the strike, it was me from Uganda, there was another colleague from Ecuador, because apparently Total has also some oil projects in those countries as well. So we were sharing our stories, and why we are demanding that the investors of Total stop investing in Total because of the destruction that is being caused by the East African crude oil pipeline in my country. And during this strike, we were approached by police in France. So it was my first time to see how police this many and very well dressed, like as if we are, you know, victims.
I get you. As if you're committing treason in some sense.
They were very bitter. They were very serious. They had batons. They had, you know, shields and all these things. I was like, wow. And there were many, like, cars kept coming and coming and coming to the action.
Wow.
Yeah, so I got scared because I was in a foreign country and I had traveled on a visit visa. So... But before that, we had a security briefing where they told us not to carry any of our IDs because they anticipated it would happen. So I'm in a foreign country. I'm moving along the streets without any ID, without, you know, any details, so anything could happen. And I was scared about my life, to be honest. But then I thought, this is the only chance probably I've got to say what I have to say or do what I have to do. So I joined the strike. We fought. We did whatever we did. And then the police just, they just circled us in. They just circled us in and they kept, you know, putting us in vans and taking, you know, a bit of us away. They kept taking people away and away.
Wow.
But so when they were like close to me, I was like, okay, what am I going to do? I don't have any ID, and they were asking for IDs and, you know, documents that speak about it. I didn't have any. And I didn't even know how to navigate Paris by that time. So I couldn't run away. And there was no even place to run, because in our country, you have a choice of running away, but there was no way you could run away. So I was dead. I told myself, whatever comes, I pray that I don't get arrested in Paris. Otherwise, maybe they will do red list me or blacklist me or something like that.
I hear you.
Yeah, I was worried about that. And then before I knew it, one of the members of parliament of the European Union who came and was doing interviews. So it was everywhere on the news in France. And when she saw the news, she came. And because we had had a conversation with her before about the East African Crude Oil Pipeline, so she came to know what we were doing in Paris and, you know, what was happening. And by that time, it was more like a political season. So there were political campaigns happening because they had voting soon. And it was also at that time when TotalEnergies had its annual meeting, I think, AGM, annual general meeting. So it was on the same day. And when this member of parliament came, we talked to her and I pleaded to her to help me get out of the mess that I was in. And surprisingly, she did help. She talked to the police officers. She shared her ID with them, and then they allowed to let me and the activists from Ecuador, who are not French people, leave. So that is how I survived being arrested in Paris. But it also happened in Germany when we organized the strike in Germany. And it happened in the US, but not at the rate at which it happens in Uganda. So
where did you organize in Germany?
In Germany, we were in Berlin. So I was invited by Fridays for Future Germany to attend a climate march. Yeah.
Okay. And you got arrested in Berlin as well?
No. Okay. I wasn't arrested in Berlin. We were approached by the police, and then the organizers of the event talked to the police, and then they let us go.
Okay. And in the US, where was this in the US?
In the US, it was in New York. We were approached by police. We had an action outside MASH. MASH is one of the reinsurers of the East African Crude Oil Pipeline when it comes to TotalEnergies. So we were requesting MASH to stop reinsuring TotalEnergies for the ECOP. So we had this action outside the MASH offices to tell them about the destruction that is being caused in Uganda by TotalEnergies so that they can stop reassuring them. So we were outside, and then we were surrounded by police. Still, the organizers talked to them, and then we are let go, and the action ended.
In the US case, the police came, but the action ended. So they let you go, but the action ended. And did the same thing happen in Berlin?
No, in Berlin, the action continued. And then in the US, we had 30 minutes of the action. So we were like at the end of the action. So when we were approached, we didn't continue.
Of course, you've had like many other minor actions or minor activities that you've done to disrupt you know, further climate damage, and you know, with a large focus on the East African crude oil pipeline. So, what are you doing when you say we have a march action? What are you actually, what are you doing?
So in simple terms, it's a peaceful protest, or you can call it a protest would be the best definition. So what we do is we mobilize people who have the same information like we do, or who are interested to join the action. So we organize or write placards or message boards with information for that particular action. This message could be directed to the people who are seeing us, or to, for example, to the company heads or to the company employees, or even like the messages on what's happening on ground in Uganda. For instance, with the ECOP, it would be, you know, stop ECOP. People's lives are being lost, you know, destruction of communities, destruction of families, or, you know, the amount of money Total has invested in such a project. Or it could be, for example, research that, for example, MASH is, you know, investing this and this amount in Total Energies and it needs to divest, you know, something like that. So these, with these message bots, we go to, for example, if our target is a company, we go to the company headquarters or offices and we hold the protest there. So sometimes it could be a sit-in protest where we just sit with placards and make sure that they are seen. Sometimes it could be our music protest where we have music, we have like speakers, you know, we speak and, you know, share information so that the people inside the building can hear us, you know, and come and see what's happening. Sometimes it could be us, you know, just sharing the information for bypassers or people in those organizations to see us. So during this march, we have like speeches from different people, from like victims, from activists, from experts, you know, from, you know, this. We share research, we share any kind of information that would help us, you know, put out our message. So we usually time ourselves, maybe say 30 minutes, or, you know, we'll be here for an hour, or, you know, it's safe to do this quick, so it'll be like 10 minutes or 15 minutes. So it depends on how much time we have. And sometimes we'll have a real match, like a protest, where we move from point A to point B. So through that, we know that we will pass these and these offices or headquarters, or, you know, meet such and such people who are very vital to the campaign or to the action. So that is how we do it. And sometimes we come when we have like a letter to deliver to the company. So we could have like a petition or a letter from the community. So we come, do the action, and then deliver the letter. So, yeah.
I, you know, this is one of those interviews that I really regret that we have such a short time, because there is indeed so much that I want to ask you. But let's sort of take a few steps back here. So you, when you got arrested, father came and gave you a piece of his mind. What made you keep going? What was it like calling him and saying, "Hey, hey, Dad, it's me again at the police station"? How did this affect the relationship with your parents? I mean, arrest after arrest after arrest. I can imagine, as an African who's supposed to be the sweet girl at home doing chores or whatever, which is true of our older generations, is arrested again and again and again. So how was this dynamic between you and your dad, who is the stronger voice, but also your mother and so forth?
So it was quite a big dilemma because by that time, like really very, very few people really understood climate change. And even my parents did not understand climate change. So I kept explaining to them what climate change really is, why I'm doing this and how it's impacting us as a community, as a country, but they still couldn't understand. So I was always that sweet girl. And I think that's why my dad really blew at me the first time I told him that I'm arrested, because he never expected it at any point. So that first time, it was really huge because I called him when I was still at the police station and he couldn't. He said, figure it out, you know. So I had to figure things out. And luckily, they let us go. I got bailed after that.
Who bailed you out?
A colleague, a friend of mine, who was by that time my mentor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you take that person for a drink afterwards?
I didn't even have money to bail myself. Yeah, but I really appreciated them. I thanked them because that was life-saving. And my dad was furious. He didn't understand what climate change was, so he didn't understand why I was doing what I was doing. And for a long time, he didn't understand. So even the other times, the second time when I got arrested, I didn't bother because I knew there was no hope that side. So I just had to, you know, call my friends or other people to help me out. So for quite a long time, my parents never understood why I was doing this and what really climate change is or what it meant to us. And when I was in my third year, I declined a bit with my performance because I was spending most of the time in climate conferences or events or actions. Well, I remember my third semester, my dad refused to pay my tuition. I was like, no. Since you decided to do what you're doing, so I'm not going to pay for your tuition. You're old enough to pay for tuition and things like that. So I had to figure things out. So I knew that there was no hope with my parents. So I started to figure things out on my own. And my mother on the other side did not also understand what I was doing, but she was a bit supportive. I think the only time she knew that what I was doing was serious is when I got interview requests and it was a German journalists, two of them. Mm-hmm. They came to Uganda to interview me. And then they wanted to talk to my parents, so ask them about their view on the work that I do. So I wouldn't call my dad because he was very furious. So I talked to my mom. I was like, Mom, I have some journalists who want to interview you about the work I do. She was like, what? People from Germany coming to see you? She never thought of anything like that. She was like, is that serious? So that's when she started to, like, you know, give me some, you know, ears or value in what I was doing. Yeah, she was excited to see the white journalists. She was like, oh, come to this and, you know.
Yeah.
So from that time, she was a bit supportive and until I finished my university. And then I started working. So when I was like after university in 2019,
how did you finish university? Since daddy was done with your fees, how did you end up finishing it?
Oh my God! I took a loan from a friend, and I paid that loan for 3 other years.
Wow! Yeah. Wow! Okay.
Yeah. So in 2019, I had a trip to Madrid. By that time, it was around the Conference of Parties.
Greta Thunberg, right?
Yes, which is COP. So mm-hmm. Greta Thunberg was going to attend, and she was, you know, like at the peak. And I attended the Conference of Parties. I met with Greta Thunberg, and that boosted like my work. It caught media attention, and my name was everywhere on the news. And then that's when my dad called me. He's like, "Where are you?" So I told him, you know, I'm in Madrid. I'm doing this. And how did you get there? So I had to explain myself. And I think that is when he started to take me seriously and, you know, what I was doing and really support me in my work. However, I was then volunteering with some NGOs here in Uganda. So I was working as a volunteer for like 2 years and I wasn't being paid any penny. So he started to get worried. He called me, he's like, "You know, you finished campus, you should be in an office seated somewhere working and earning a monthly, you know, salary, but you're everywhere on the streets, you know, doing this, you're not earning anything. Why don't you come and, you know, look for a job in the office?" So I told him, "Daddy, I'm passionate about this, you know, and, you know, I want to do this as a person." So it really never came to his, you know, his head about why I was doing what I was doing. But my story is literally, I grew up in a farming family, which lives next to Lake Victoria. I grew up in an extended family, so I used to see how my grandmother struggled with the farm, you know, with farming, with a family. So she was like an all-rounder. She used to take care of the animals. She used to take care of the garden. Seeing this, I also grow up wanting to be a farmer because we were old. Yes. And I remember vividly a time when we experienced heavy rains, and it rained consecutively for 3 days. This was the most that I had seen it rain. And I was worried because we didn't get out of the house for about 2 days. And yet our kitchen was outside the main house. So you had to cross over with a compound and then you walk to the kitchen. So we were hungry. We weren't going to the farm to collect food for those days when it was really raining with lightning. The roads were submerged. You know, the soil was, the water was just everywhere. So it really made transportation hard or movement hard. And it also made life hard for us. So on the third day when the rains were, you know, reducing a bit, my grandmother moved outside the house to see what had happened to the gardens, because we kept hearing, you know, sounds, you know, of trees breaking, you know, of crops, lightning, you know, all this, it was heavy. So when she looked outside to see what had happened to the garden, it was disaster. Everything, all the crops were bent, you know, were broken to one side, you know, the trees were cut, they were down, you know, the crops, the maize, you know, the beans, everything was, you know, very like disturbed and distracted.
Oh my goodness.
So we couldn't correct or mend anything. So we just had to let it be. We had to clear the gardens and, you know, put out everything. So that season, we didn't sell anything at all because the crops were destroyed. So by then I was very young. I was about 10 years or 11 years. And I remember asking my grandmother what had happened. And she said to me that the gods had punished us. So I asked her, why would the gods punish us? We didn't anything wrong. Mm. So she said the gods had punished us, and that's why our garden was destroyed. So it didn't sit well with me that the gods would punish someone for nothing that they had done. So I kept on, it was a question in my head. So when I joined university, I realized that what my grandmother was trying to explain, the God's punishment, was actually called climate change.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, so I joined this discussion that was at my university. It was organized by a local non-government organization, and they were talking about climate change, which I didn't know about. So a friend of mine at the university calls me, is like, Hilda, there's food at this event, come and attend. So I only attended this dialogue because I wanted to eat. I was hungry, and there was free food. So I joined the discussion, and in the mid of the discussion, they talk about climate change. They explain what it is, how it affects us. And I was so touched, because what was shared is exactly what I had seen growing up in my village. But none of the people in the village know that it's called climate change. And from this discussion, I got interested to learn more about climate change. How can we reverse it? You know, what can we do? What are the solutions at hand? And that's how my passion for climate justice developed. So it stemmed out of my experiences growing up as a young child in a community that is affected by climate change, but one which is not aware that what they are experiencing is actually called climate change. And to make matters worse, this disaster, climate change, is being fueled by rich countries or organizations that don't even feel the impact of its disasters. So I joined the climate movement to create awareness, but also to educate other people, especially girls of my girls who, so that they don't have to pass through the same experience I passed through growing up, you know, missing school, having to sit home for months while other people went to school, you know, coming from a farmer's background. If you don't sell anything in the season, that means you won't study. And you won't earn, because farming was our main source of income. So I joined the climate movement to create awareness, to, you know, educate masses about climate change, but also to find solutions to this problem, because most of the African countries face this same issue. But Africa as a continent, we barely contribute 5 or even 4% of the global greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change. So, yeah, that is why I added my voice. That is why all the arrests, I didn't really think twice whether I'll be arrested. Yeah, I just do something, you know, to do something so that my grandmother won't have to go another season without selling her agricultural products or earning, or some child somewhere having to miss their lessons because the parents can't afford their tuition, or, you know, something.
Wow. Look, I think you're a beacon of hope, and there's just so much about you and your story that we didn't cover here. So what are the resources that you'd like to point our listeners to, websites, social media? Where can you be found and more information about you be gotten from those like me who are interested in more aspects of your story?
Okay. So I have social media accounts in my name's Hilda Flavia Nakawie. So there's Twitter, there's Instagram, and there's also a Wikipedia page in my name, Hilda Flavia Nakabia, where you can find more resources. And also the website of Fridays for Future Uganda, which is the organization I'm working with. So it's www.f4fug.org, like O-R-G.
Okay, so to close off the conversation, I know you have another meeting to attend to. This is the JET, the Just Energy Transition podcast, and we are indeed intellectually, socially a JET for the movement. So I want you to tell our listeners and to tell our stakeholders why it is that you deserve a first-class seat on this JET, why it is that we should allow you to come to the front of the JET and jump off the JET in a first-class parachute to continue to do your work.
Hi, everyone. My name is Hilda Flavia Nakawie. I am a victim of the climate crisis, and I refuse to stay silent because I believe that my voice matters, my story matters, and together we can make a difference in the world. But that difference can only be made if we are part and parcel of the actions towards this difference that we want to see in our communities. I believe that a safe and clean environment, a sustainable future is possible. And I call upon each and everyone listening in to join the JET. Thank you.
Yes, that is Hilda, ladies and gentlemen. Look, when I met you, there was just something about you that I could feel. I could just feel like you're the real deal, and it's so inspiring. I meet many people in this field, but when I came across you and heard you speak, I could just feel like, wow, there's power here, and there's truth here, and sincerity here. I just want you to know how lucky your husband and your son and your family and your country and all of us in the movement are to have you. So thank you very much for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into our JET podcast today. Before you disembark, don't forget to subscribe and stay connected. For more resources, updates, and ways to take action, visit jetvoices.com. Until our next JET flight, stay inspired, stay engaged, and keep pushing for a just energy transition.